Hello, it's Friday 22nd of January 2021. I'm Hannah Pearson from Payette Anderson. On this week's show, we're delighted to welcome behavioural economist and tourism marketer Sandra Thomas-Comenon. So, let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So today, Hannah and I are looking forward to chatting with US-based behavioral economist, tourism marketer, and fellow podcaster, Sandra Thomas-Comenon. Welcome to the show, Sandra. How are you doing today, and where are you?
Thank you for having me on. I'm actually based in Denver, Colorado.
And how's the weather out there today? Is it cold?
It's actually been beautiful. I was able to get out and get into the sun today.
Beautiful. And we're actually on different days, aren't we? We're recording this on Friday morning here in Kuala Lumpur, but you're still in the evening time over there in Denver.
That's correct. It's 7 o'clock at night, Thursday night.
Great. So let's bridge the time divide. Hannah, over to you.
Yeah, so let's start at the beginning. And it's always great to chat with a fellow podcaster. And Gary and I, we've listened to some of your podcasts, Behavioral Economics and Marketing, which is great. And they're really short and concise and really insightful. So why did you decide to start podcasting? And how has the focus of your podcast changed since you came up with that initial idea?
So the initial idea came from, I was often asked, how do you apply economics degree to marketing? And I think this really stems from a general misconception as to what economics truly is. So most people think of it as finance or more on that macro side of GDP, but economics is so much more than that. And I wanted a chance to showcase that correlation between behavioral economics and marketing. So when I started, my goal was to just do 3 episodes. That's all I really had in mind. But I started to get really great feedback. And I really love when my listeners reach out to me. And so a couple of the feedback quotes I got, I had one listener who told me that he was able to apply the anchoring effect to negotiate a higher salary during COVID. I also had a college student that said they were having a hard time understanding hyperbolic discounting and that my episode on the topic really saved her life. So I pushed forward with more episodes. But as a result, the remainder of the first season was done in a more spontaneous plan-as-I-go fashion. So in November, I took a little time off to assess the results and plan out a new season. And I did that based on the listener feedback, but also based on the idea that I wanted to really dig deeper into behavioral economics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that leads us neatly into our next question, Sandra. So behavioral economics, and I have to say, I'm a bit of an economics nerd, so and I work a lot in trend economics as well, so this is a really good topic for me. But it's a science that provides insights into consumer decisions and preferences. So why did you choose this as your particular area of economics and your sort of career path to follow?
So I really actually love to tell about this story. Well, I was a late bloomer and I returned to university kind of mid-career. And on my first day of classes, my economics professor burst into the room, held up his arms in the air in this larger-than-life way and exclaimed, "Economics is the study of decision-making." From that moment on, I was kind of hooked. I knew this was kind of the path that I wanted to follow, and especially as I could apply these concepts to marketing.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something my husband studied economics as well. And we always have an argument because I studied classics, Latin and French. And he's always, "That's useless. You should have studied economics. Economics is the study of everything." I don't quite agree with him, but yeah, economics is super interesting. So you got into economics and then from 2019 to 2020, you took on the direct marketing and market research role for Inside Japan Tours. So 2019 to 2020 is kind of like a tricky period globally. So what were you working on and what were the objectives?
So the driving force for my hiring was that the US branch had been down year over year by a couple $1 million, whereas other players in the same space just weren't seeing those same losses. So my role was originally brought on to kind of analyze the situation, create some strategy and implement that strategy to fix it. And kind of the greatest off-the-bat accomplishment was that the first 3 of the 6 months that I was there were the highest grossing months ever in the history of the U.S. branch. And we returned from that hole with a 30% year-over-year growth. But as you said, it really was a tricky period, especially marketing travel products. So one key strategy that I implemented was to hyper segment based on behavior. And I also did a little bit of demographic segmenting, but it was really on those behaviors that proved to be very useful. You know, and then on the travel advisor side, I found that the travel agents were looking for the for a chance to skill up during the first few months of the pandemic. So creating informational and engaging content really hit the mark on that side.
That's interesting. So Inside Japan Tours, I mean, it does what it says on the tin, but is that a US-based company or is it based in Japan?
So actually, they have a worldwide footprint. They're headquartered in the UK and they have offices in Australia, US, and then Southeast Asia, and two offices in Japan.
Now, before that, you worked for other travel and tour companies in the US. What would you say were some of the key learnings about travel and tourism marketing and economic decision-making that you learned from those roles?
Yeah, so I actually have really grown to appreciate the role of a travel advisor. In my 13 years of working in the industry, I have seen so many shocks to the market, either on the destination side or the source side, from pandemics and friendly missiles to volcanoes and other natural disasters. And the key learning was that travel advisor business was always the last to go and the first to come back. Travel advisors know their clients and their clients' risk tolerance, and they also have their backs when something goes wrong. So booking with a travel advisor is kind of like an extra layer of insurance. And my hope is going into 2021, 2022, that there will be a big boom for the travel advisor business, at least in the US.
Yeah, it's a remarkably resilient business, the travel advisory sector in the US. I worked for ASTA, the American Society of Travel Agents, at the early 2000s, so right after 9/11. I worked for them for about 2 or 3 years. And back in those days, you know, there was a lot of rumors that, you know, it was the end of the travel advisor, that the economy was going to change, the travel economy was going to change, everybody would be booking online. But here we are, like 20 years later, and we're still talking about the resilience of travel advisors.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And it's very often that I'll say, oh, I work in the travel industry. And they're like, oh, well, is that still a thing? And yes, it's absolutely a thing.
So let's talk about tourism marketing in the US. And over the past 4 years, tourism's not really been considered a priority sector by the Trump administration. So now you've got a new president. Is that going to change, do you think?
Well, you know, when you talk about priority sectors, this is actually my biggest pet peeve. Travel has never really been considered a priority sector in the US, especially when you think about academia. Most of the top economic journals do not actually publish tourism or travel research, which actually reflects and propagates that lack of funding for tourism research. And I see this as surprising. I know that you probably do as well, but it has such a huge impact economically and throughout our society, on our country as throughout the world. A few travel stats that I've kind of dug up about America is that travel supports 1 in 10 jobs in America. It's the second largest industry export. And in 2019, domestic and international inbound spending reached $1.1 trillion. This is such a surprising thing that, you know, it just doesn't get that same notoriety as some of the other industries. And my hope is that going into the next 4 years or so, that this temporary loss of the travel industry and the resounding impact that has had on our economy and society, that we might actually see this kind of more attention brought to travel in terms of funding research, government policies, and of course, increased marketing dollars and efforts worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, Sandra. I mean, you have pretty strong tourism bodies, ASTA, there's a number of others that do speak for the travel industry. You have a pretty strong and robust travel industry media there. But you haven't really had, sort of over the last few years, sort of the brand America idea was to posit America as a single destination. But it's mostly been done at state level or even city level internationally, hasn't it, in terms of marketing the US?
Right. Our national tourist board is just about 10 years old. It is so new for us to be marketing travel at the national level.
Does that surprise you?
So it really does surprise me that the national tourist board is so young, because of the fact that we have so many tourism assets throughout our country. And just bringing them all together under one umbrella makes the most sense, especially for attracting kind of a lot of people. And I think that we haven't really done that well in attracting that many people. In 2019, we had 79.3 million inbound travelers, which sounds like a lot, but it was actually 10 million less than France. And 54% of those travelers came from the Americas. I think that we can do a lot better than this with that national tourism board.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you think that America might need to consider? I mean, you've kind of been in the Asian market, I suppose, by working for Inside Japan. So what do you think America needs to change or consider when promoting, America as a destination to Asian markets?
So my idea is that we attract travelers not just to kind of those bi-coastal cities, but to the lesser known destinations. True America is kind of, you know, the natural vistas, the mountains and the Niagara Falls even, but also those small quaint towns in like the Berkshires. That's what true America is. And, you know, When I travel, I often talk to people and they'll say, I've been to America. I was there for 2 weeks. But when I ask them where they went, it turns out that they really never left Manhattan. And to kind of put that more into perspective, you wouldn't go to Japan and spend 2 weeks in Tokyo. You wouldn't get a real taste of the country.
That's true. I'm a complete America file. I love traveling in America. It's such an incredibly diverse country, and it's so beautiful. You're right. One of the interesting things, particularly the Chinese market, you know, that there were attempts to try and bring in more Chinese travelers, probably pre-Trump, but it was quite successful. But you're right, they were coming into the main city market, so LA, New York, Chicago. But then it's up to Chinese travelers almost to find their own way and to discover what they want to find from America. And you probably need to incorporate that a little bit more so you give them more information and more ideas.
Right, some more itineraries kind of just readily available to them.
And do you think that US travel companies have got much knowledge of kind of the Asian inbound market? I mean, do they just see it as Asia? Or do you think that they see, you know, Chinese travelers who are different to Japanese travelers, different to Southeast Asian travelers?
I think that, this isn't where I'm really from, but my guess is that some companies would probably see them that way. But I think that a lot of companies are able to differentiate. Kind of another stat to think about is of the U.S., the inbound travelers of 2019, the ones that weren't from the Americas, 34.7% were from Europe and 29.8% from Asia. That's only a 5% difference. It's not really that, you know, we don't understand Asia that well. I just don't think that we do a great job of marketing travel anywhere in the world.
So, I mean, where we're sitting now, we're in January 2021, and COVID-19 has upturned markets, industries, and entire economies worldwide. So whether we're talking about tourism or whether we're talking about anything else, let's get back to behavioral marketing theory and practice. Do you think that that will shift and develop further after the pandemic, or will the basic tenets and precepts still apply?
So the great thing about behavioral economics is that it is still a relatively new discipline, and it is always constantly changing, shifting, and growing. But I do believe that the basic concepts will still apply, and we can just apply them in new ways. You know, so for example, the availability heuristic. This says that people make decisions based on the information that is readily available to them at that moment. And right now, at least in America, on social media, it is socially unacceptable to talk about your travels. If you post something on social media, you often get a lot of negative comments or angry faces. So you don't really see many travel pics or stories, yet people are currently traveling. According to the TSA checkpoint numbers, over 5 million people traveled by air in the U.S. last week alone. But that information is not readily available to the average person. So they assume that no one is really traveling except for the people that have to travel for work or family or whatever, and then a few other people that are ruining it for kind of the rest of us. From a marketing standpoint, using that availability heuristic, we want to show the masses traveling. This means that as people in the travel industry, when we travel, we want to post those pictures and talk about our travels and talk about the safety measures in place. We also want to encourage our customers to post their pictures. And what this does is it not only allows people to see people traveling and get that idea of it's more normal again, but it also allows them, if they see their friends traveling and then they see that their friends do not get sick from traveling, it shows that risk more kind of in that it's realistic sense versus its perceived sense. And then the other thing that we want to do is to make information about the level of travel readily available for the average person in a positive light. I don't know about you guys, but in America right now, when we see people traveling in the news, it's always like they're not wearing a mask or they're not socially distanced. We want to actually show the safety information. We want to show the people that are traveling safely and doing it well.
It's interesting you mentioned there about the sort of social media shaming of travel. When did you notice that started to sort of take hold?
I honestly started noticing it back in March. I had been traveling for business in March, and I did kind of feel a little like, should I post this or not? Because I saw people saying things like, you know, all over the social media.
And you also talked about, Sandra, I really love this IKEA effect that you talked about in your podcast. Do you think that how could that be used to rebuild tourism? Or could you explain to the readers what IKEA effect is first, I suppose?
Okay, I feel IKEA effect, just like kind of the store, is the idea that if you take part in the making of something, you put more, you attribute more to it, you get more utility out of it. So as far as applying that to kind of travel, it's really about having the traveler take part in the planning of their travels more, take part in the kind of building of it. And that's kind of how you would be able to apply that to marketing at this time.
So season two of your podcast, which you discussed right at the beginning, Sandra, you've looked at behavioral economics in marketing and its aspects of leadership and decision-making. And to me, that is all quite fascinating because we have really seen over the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 months, a sort of crisis of leadership, leadership of government, leadership of businesses. There's so much uncertainty around the world right now. So how important do you think leadership and decision-making will be as we try to rebuild travel and tourism?
I think it's very important. I mean, right now, as you say, we're actually experiencing what's called ambiguous loss. And that's, you know, personally, as well as company level and government level, kind of all across the board, decision makers can't really assess the totality of a loss until we're on the other side of it. And so economics, and particularly behavioral economics, can really help leaders to better assess their losses right while they're in it. But another reason why I took this focus for season two is an anticipation of a return to travel and business as usual. Not that it's going to be anything like business as usual. Marketing professionals and leaders will be facing completely new challenges in many different ways. One such way is that, you know, companies have recently laid off much of their staff, meaning that when travel opens back up and they have a ton of clients, they're going to have to hire at like fast paces, and they'll have to quickly train their staff. And while in certain occupations that might be fine, a travel company, specifically if they specialize in far-fetched regions or countries such as Japan or Germany, where there's a lot of information to kind of know about, they really will have a difficult time with that, especially being able to deliver that same quality and high level of knowledge that they were once able to deliver. This mass hiring and lower level training will put a huge strain on a leader's resources.
That's fascinating. That's something that we've been talking about on the podcast for the last few months, is this sort of complete disconnect between the supply and demand equation. You know, we don't know how badly the supply and the travel infrastructure has been damaged for the longer term. You know, if the recovery is strong, companies are going to have to rehire, retrain, and skill up very, very quickly. What kind of leadership challenges will that bring?
Oh, so it will bring a lot of leadership challenges. I mean, one thing that I'm going to be talking about in my next episode is managing cognitive dissonance. And quickly, cognitive dissonance is when your expectation doesn't align with reality. So for example, imagine going to a restaurant, you order a meal, but the waiter delivers it just wrong, maybe an hour late, maybe that had olives when you requested no olives, whatever it was, you will experience a cognitive dissonance. This is often a much bigger deal for larger purchases such as cars, homes, or vacation packages. But applying this to management and leadership can take on a whole new meaning. So in this example of kind of mass hiring, imagine you're going through this really busy season and you have to attract a pool of candidates. That takes a while. They say the average hire takes about 3 months to happen. So between attracting the pool of candidates, hiring, the HR rep will narrow it down to a select few, and then you interview those. You select a candidate. That candidate needs to give notice or some other reason, takes a few weeks to start. Then they go through the training. Normally, you might spend 2 to 3 weeks training, but because you needed them ready to work a month ago, you knock it down to 1 to 2 weeks. But after a week or two, they decide that the position isn't what they thought they were signing up for. This episode will examine how leaders can avoid that cognitive dissonance through hiring practices, expectation management, and communication.
Yeah, expectation management is a really, really on point item because, you know, over the last, 10 years, travel and tourism worldwide has just grown exponentially. And travelers from Asia in particular have become much more discerning, much more choosy, and much more expecting of high standards of service. So one of the effects of this transition that we may be going through is that service standards may drop because companies, as you said, are rehiring or reskilling. So there may be this sort of lag between what they were used to before and what's going to happen in future.
Oh yeah, that's absolutely, I can totally see that happening, especially because you're skilling up quickly. And especially if your candidates don't come in with huge country information, especially kind of if they don't come from a tourism background, that expectation management would be a huge factor.
So let's talk about market research now. And that's another area that you podcast about and you've written about. And it's a kind of tricky concept really over the last 12 months, particularly in Asia, because there's very little base travel data. So consumers are kind of responding to research in terms of either their memory or of past travels or their dreams of future travels. So how should market research evolve? And what do you think about the value of travel or consumer sentiment surveys?
So this is such a great question. I recently researched the correlation between several US-based longitudinal travel sentiment surveys and then actual travel behaviors, such as buying airfare or passing through a TSA checkpoint. What I found was that while travel sentiment remained somewhat static, travel behaviors increased dramatically. So what that kind of means is that surveys aren't really great at predicting travel behavior. And I guess that my problem isn't necessarily with travel surveys, because I actually am a really big fan of conducting surveys. They're easy to send out. You can survey your current clientele as well as potential customers. But the idea that surveys are too subjective means that they shouldn't be the only tool in a market research wheelhouse. I'm personally a big fan of objective data. For example, considering data from countries that have opened during the pandemic or from shocks that have happened in the past and how travel behaviors changed around those.
I mean, we live in an unreal era. You know, consumers are finding their ways around it, travel brands are finding their way around it, and so are marketers as well. I mean, do you think that perhaps travel marketers have learned quite a lot from some of the mistakes that they've made in these travel sentiment surveys?
So the thing that I see is that with the onset of COVID, a lot of travel marketers that had never done a survey before just started sending out surveys and eating up that data. I think that some of them have seen that that data hasn't been correct, but I think that it's really going to be after things are back to normal where they'll be able to really assess it.
So what projects are you currently working on, Sandra?
I always have a whole bunch of irons in the fire, so to speak. One project that I'm currently working on is on pent-up demand. So this is a term that's been thrown around quite a bit lately, especially in the travel industry. And I dug into the data, looking at kind of the last shocks to the industry. For example, the right after 9/11, how travel behavior changed. And then I also looked at when certain destinations opened up. I worked with the U.S. National Parks and the Croatian Tourist Board to consider the objective data of how travel behaviors changed after and during, you know, reopening of those destinations.
This idea of pent-up demand is fascinating because it's an obsession for the travel industry right now, and understandably so. Here in Asia, we've had this term revenge tourism, which has been banded, but it kind of came from China. You know, this idea that people have been locked down for a long time, they're used to traveling, it's become part of their lifestyle. Some people may have a little bit more discretionary income because they haven't really been spending much over recent months. So they want revenge. They want to get back out and travel again. But we also have, Hannah and I have always also been discussing this idea that it's a little bit easier to revenge spend in the current context in your own country. You understand the situations, you understand where the red zones are, where the green zones are. But once you start traveling overseas again, the whole concept changes. And we go back to this idea of, well, is it safe to travel again? You know, so your ideas of where you want to go, where you have these pent up ideas, it's going to be about availability and safety, I would imagine. What do you think about that?
I absolutely agree with that. But the Croatian tourism numbers for 2020 were actually quite promising. So it does make me think, and I was looking at from the US, but I also spoke with them about some of their other tourist incoming numbers, and it really was promising. But I definitely think that idea of ambiguity, we as humans just don't like ambiguity, and you don't want to book something, get all excited for it, and then have it canceled at the last minute, or get to a foreign country and have not be able to get back to your own country, or have the quarantine rules change. You don't want that. You don't want that ambiguity. And so I think that, yes, right now people are going to be more comfortable with doing the traveling locally, domestically. But as countries open up, I definitely think that people will be open to going to them.
So overall then, are you optimistic, pessimistic, or somewhere in between about tourism and marketing for 2021?
So I would say in general, I am a realistic optimist. But with regards to the situation, we've all had trips canceled this year. I've had several trips canceled. And, you know, back in April, we were thinking, oh, by August, this will be all over. We'll be able to travel again. So I am a little bit pessimistic at this point, but it will be a model of a variety of complex variables. And we really have to see kind of how things play out. But what I can say is that in all new technology diffusion, there are the frontliners, the early adopters, all the way through to the late majority and the laggards. I don't think this will be any different. I want to see that mass rollout of the vaccine, like everyone else in our industry, as well as that standardized protocol of quarantine and testing. And then I think that people will need to see these in place for a few months before jumping on the bandwagon.
Yeah, agreed. I think it will be the same in Asia, I think.
I think realistic optimist is just my favorite word of the week. So thank you for that, Sandra.
You're welcome.
So Sandra, we're almost at the end of our interview now. So where can our listeners find you if they want to find out more about what you do?
So LinkedIn is a great way to connect with me. As far as listening to my podcast, it's Behavioral Economics and Marketing, and can be found on any of the major channels such as Spotify or iTunes. It's hosted on Podbean, if that helps, and just do a quick search.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Sandra. It's been really great to hear things from a US perspective and from an economics perspective as well, right, Gary?
Yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's been a great chat. Thank you, Sandra.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I've really enjoyed it as well.
So that brings us to the end of this week's show. We hope you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed with Sandra or what we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@theseasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Yeah, meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Podchaser, Castbox, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each app. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please rate and review us, as that helps other people to find the show.
Yes, please. And that's a wrap for this week. We're off to start planning next week's show, which will focus on Malaysia. And we look forward to talking more Southeast Asia travel and tourism again with you very soon.
Yeah, thanks very much, Sandra. Great chat.
Thank you.